Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. We wish all of our listeners out there a very happy Easter, Passover, and spring break this week. Today we open our show with news about the latest stumbles in the White House, including the Trump family taking a pass on a Passover dinner at the White House and the First Lady dropping the ball in organizing the annual egg roll for children on the White House lawn. From Egypt, a much more somber story about bombings at Christian churches, and we have reaction from the head of the Minorities Humanitarian Foundation here in San Diego. We'll have details on new Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch's confirmation, and then hear about the latest developments on that shocking story of a doctor who was beaten up and dragged off a United Airlines flight for refusing to give up his seat for an airline employee. On our Capitol Report, learn about a bill introduced by a California senator and a San Diego congressman to ban the use of cluster weapons, which have killed and maimed many civilians, including children. From Public News Service, hear why some California seniors are giving a frosty reception to members of Congress coming home on spring recess. We also have some good news for all San Diego County residents. Southern California Edison has agreed to enter into settlement talks with Citizens Oversight, a watchdog group that sued seeking to force Edison to move dangerous nuclear wastes away from the shoreline at San Onofre and out of San Diego County. The case of missing El Cajon man Elijah Bear Diaz will be profiled on a national TV show next week, and we'll have details on today's show. From Sacramento, we've got good news from Governor Brown, who has declared the statewide drought is over. The Lakeside Rodeo is coming up later this month, so today we'll be re-airing our entertaining interview with the Lakeside Rodeo's comical and courageous rodeo clown. Then on Destination East County, hear about all the most fun festivals and events coming up across our region, from egg hunts and Easter carnivals to butterfly festivals, concerts, the start of the Cajon Classic car show revving up, and much, much more. Liz Alper then has some big news for sports fans. Aztecs basketball coach Steve Fisher, the most winning coach in Mountain West history, is stepping down. We'll have a look back at his memorable career and tell you who's stepping up to fill his shoes. So stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
The annual White House Seder dinner marking the start of Passover was held on Monday with Jewish staffers and friends. But President Donald Trump took a pass on the annual Passover tradition and did not attend, even though he was reportedly in the White House at the time. Nor did any member of the Trump family participate. Not even Trump's daughter, Ivanka, or her Jewish husband, Jared Kushner. President Barack Obama began the tradition and joined the White House Seder along with his family for all 8 years of his presidency. Following Trump's snub, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer further offended Jews. While speaking about the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, Spicer suggested Assad was worse than Adolf Hitler because Hitler, quote, didn't sink to using chemical weapons. But in fact, Hitler used cyanide gas to murder Jews in German concentration camps during World War II when 6 million Jewish people perished. Steve Goldstein, executive director of the Anne Frank Center, posted on Facebook, "On Passover, no less, Sean Spicer has engaged in Holocaust denial, the most offensive form of fake news imaginable, by denying Hitler gassed millions of Jews to death. Spicer's statement is the most evil slur upon a group of people we have heard from a White House press secretary." The Anne Frank Center is named for the young teen girl who died in one of Hitler's concentration camps. This is not the first time the Trump administration has offended Jews. On Holocaust Remembrance Day, Trump issued a statement that failed to mention Jews. His top aide, Steve Bannon, previously published anti-Semitic material on Breitbart News. Trump himself, during his campaign, retweeted messages from blatant anti-Semites and white supremacists. The White House also managed to offend many Christians this week by sharply scaling back the annual White House Easter egg hunt. Melania Trump failed to follow the tradition of past first ladies and has not hired the staff that customarily organizes that event and others. In the past, 80,000 wooden eggs with a White House emblem have been ordered as eggs for egg hunt participants, according to the White House website. But this year, a manufacturer of the eggs in Maine took to Twitter to publicize the lack of any order after the White House's president and first lady failed to respond to his earlier reminders. The Trump administration finally ordered just 18,000 of the eggs, the New York Times reports. The White House has reportedly not sent any invitations to public schools or military families whose children joyfully joined in the White House egg hunt in the past. The White House has not announced any A-list celebrity attendees, though a lone Sesame Street character is set to appear at the egg hunt. Ironic, since President Trump's budget seeks to eliminate all funding for public television, which airs the popular Sesame Street children's program. The White House egg roll began back in 1878 under President Rutherford B. Hayes. President Richard Nixon first added the Easter Bunny to the festivities, and President Ronald Reagan added the now popular egg hunt to the traditional egg roll on the White House lawn. It is not yet known whether any member of the Trump family will join the Easter egg activities set for Sunday. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Bombings on churches in two Egyptian cities on Palm Sunday have killed at least 45 people, the New York Times reports. The attacks targeted Christian worshippers after a December declaration by ISIS or the Islamic State threatening to slaughter Christians at their places of worship, homes, and other locations in Egypt. The attacks included St. Mark's Cathedral in Alexandria, the historic seat of Christianity in Egypt. The other bombing targeted the Nile city of Tanta. In response to the attacks, the Egyptian government has declared a state of emergency and is cracking down on social media, a move some fear could stifle free speech along with the spread of terrorist propaganda. Locally, Mark Arabo, president of the Minority Humanities Foundation here in San Diego, is speaking out to denounce the brutal bombings. In a statement sent to media, Arabo says, "Our thoughts and prayers go to the Christians of Egypt hurt by the senseless acts of violence on this most holy day." Arabo's organization has fought to find safe havens for persecuted Christians from the Middle East, including Iraqi Chaldeans and Syrians. The Coptic Christians are an ancient historical Christian community in Egypt. Arabo concludes, "The killings by ISIS show that the war against Christianity goes on. ISIS knows no bounds, and they will stop at nothing to perpetuate a holy war against innocent civilians of all faiths. For the sake of liberty and humanity, we must put an end to the savagery that is ISIS once and for all," he concluded. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Neil Gorsuch begins his duties this week as a newly appointed justice on the Supreme Court after the Senate invoked the nuclear option to change long-standing Senate rules and block a filibuster by Democrats. All but two Democrats had agreed to vote against confirming Gorsuch, including California Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. Gorsuch, President Donald Trump's appointee, joins a divided court and will likely be the saving vote in close decisions. A staunch conservative, Gorsuch is likely to follow in the voting tradition of the late Justice Scalia, a staunch conservative. The court is expected to soon decide landmark cases that could roll back key labor protections and women's reproductive rights, potentially even reversing Roe v. Wade. Gorsuch will first have to go through long-standing traditions aimed at teaching humility to each new justice. These include serving on the High Court's cafeteria committee to plan meals, taking notes during closed-door conferences, and rising to open the door if someone knocks while the justices are in the conference room. Gorsuch takes over these newcomer duties from Justice Ellen Kagan, the second most recent appointee to the High Court. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Videos have gone viral on social media showing a passenger violently beaten, bloodied, and dragged off a United Airlines flight after he refused to give up his seat on a full flight so that United personnel could take his place. The brutal incident has sparked outrage, a boycott, and calls for reforms. The passenger, Dr. David Dow of Kentucky, told airline personnel that he had to be on the flight to return home and see patients. One video shows Dow's head being banged against the arm of a seat by Chicago police summoned by United. A second video shows Dr. Dow, his face dripping with blood, saying, "They kill me," repeatedly, and pleading to go home. Dr. Dow's family has said he suffered a concussion, lost several teeth, and will need reconstructive surgery for a broken nose. Dr. Dow, who once escaped Vietnam in a small boat, has said that being dragged off the United flight was far more terrifying, his lawyer told media. United's CEO initially stood by the airline's actions. The airline also circulated negative information about the doctor's past in a seeming effort to discredit him, although other passengers said the doctor did nothing wrong, was not combative or violent, merely insisting he had to get home and declining to be bumped off the flight for which he had paid. After the airline's stock plunged $1 billion or more, late-night comics ridiculed United and consumers launched a boycott, United's CEO belatedly issued an apology and then said he was horrified by the videos. He also announced that United will temporarily suspend its practice of overbooking and stop using police to remove passengers who are bumped. But some say that's not enough. Change.org has launched a petition calling for the resignation of United's CEO. In China, some questioned whether Dow was singled out instead of other passengers because he is Asian. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has called on the Trump administration to enact regulations to end the practice of overbooking and protect passengers against such abusive treatment in the future. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Gene Carpenter with East County Magazine's Capitol Report. California Senator Dianne Feinstein has introduced the Cluster Munitions Civilian Protection Act, a bill to restrict the use and export of dangerous cluster munitions. San Diego Congressman Daryl Issa is co-sponsor of a companion bill in the House. Cluster munitions are bombs, rockets, or artillery shells containing submunitions that can leave behind unexploded ordnance, posing dangers to civilians for generations. This unexploded ordnance can be buried and hidden from view or lie in plain sight, where it can be mistaken for toys or even airdropped assistance. Cluster bombs have contaminated 24 countries, including Laos, Lebanon, and Ukraine. In 2015, civilians in at least 8 countries died from these weapons. Senator Feinstein says, "These indiscriminate weapons have left a legacy of unexploded munitions in war-torn areas." While the United States has not widely used cluster munitions since the 2003 invasion of Iraq, U.S.-made cluster bombs have recently been used in Yemen, endangering civilians. She adds, "The United States should join the more than 100 nations that have agreed to never again use or export these weapons by signing the Convention on Cluster Munitions." Senator Patrick Leahy, co-sponsor of Feinstein's bill, says, "Cluster munitions, which are scattered by the thousands over a wide area, have caused horrific suffering and death among civilians in every conflict in which they have been used, often years after the fighting ended. Our bill would put in place strict criteria to reduce harm to innocents," he says. But Senator Leahy adds, "The Pentagon should end its use of these indiscriminate weapons." The bill prohibits the U.S. military from using cluster munitions if more than 1% of the weapon's submunitions result in unexploded ordnance. It would also prohibit export of cluster munitions unless the receiving country agrees that the munitions will only be used against clearly defined military targets, not in civilian areas. In addition, the bill encourages the United States to join 100 other nations and agree to the International Convention on Cluster Munitions, which bans the production, stockpiling, sale, or use of cluster weapons.
As members of Congress return home for their spring recess, they're starting to hear from seniors in their districts who oppose any attempt to revive the Republican plan to repeal Obamacare. The American Health Care Act, or AHCA, was withdrawn at the end of March when it couldn't get enough votes, but negotiations are underway to attract the support of the conservative Freedom Caucus. Blanca Castro with AARP California says that could mean gutting protections for people with pre-existing conditions. She says volunteers are fanning out in each of California's 53 congressional districts to make their point.
The proposal that they had before would have left millions of people without any health insurance because the age tax rating that they were proposing required people who are older to pay up to 5 times more.
AHCA supporters say it would free people from the government mandate to get insurance, lift burdensome regulations, and encourage more competition among insurers. But a recent study showed 2.6 million Californians between ages 50 and 64 have pre-existing medical conditions and would be at risk of being dropped from their insurance or priced out of the market if the AHCA or an equivalent passes. Castro says the first Republican proposal also contained a provision allowing insurance companies to charge seniors a lot more in premiums than younger customers.
They're either scheduling meetings or attending local events that members of Congress may be hosting and urging not bringing up a repeal of the Affordable Care Act unless there is a replacement that will keep people with pre-existing conditions covered.
U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan's first proposal would also have slashed billions of dollars from Medicaid, forcing millions of lower-income people off the program and into the high-priced individual insurance market to get coverage. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Just days before an April 14th court hearing filed by Citizens Oversight seeking to force removal of nuclear waste from storage along the ocean near the closed San Onofre nuclear power plant, Southern California Edison has agreed to enter into negotiations to move the nuclear storage elsewhere. Both parties have asked for a postponement of that hearing in order to pursue a settlement agreement. Attorneys Mike Aguirre and Maria Severson filed a stipulation on behalf of the plaintiffs and Edison, joined by the state attorney general representing the California Coastal Commission. Aguirre states, "People of goodwill must come together and work to find a solution that is in the best interests of the people of the state of California." Tom Palmisano, the vice president and chief nuclear officer for Edison, the majority owner of the San Onofre facility, says, "We are hopeful that settlement discussions will permit the parties to reach a mutually agreeable solution." The suit was filed in November 2015 after the Coastal Commission granted Edison's permit to expand dry cask storage of used nuclear fuel at San Onofre. 1/3 of San Onofre's used fuel is currently in dry cask storage, and the remaining 2/3 is stored in steel-lined concrete pools. Edison had proposed to move the fuel from the pools into dry storage by 2019, where it would stay until an off-site storage facility becomes available, which could be indefinitely. Citizens Oversight, a watchdog group founded by El Cajon resident Ray Lutz, has contended that the location is unsafe because over 8 million people live within 50 miles of the site and because the canisters would be located just 100 feet from the ocean. Plaintiffs argued that the canisters could leak or be damaged by saltwater, tsunamis, or earthquakes since the site is in an active earthquake zone. Radioactive waste at the site will remain dangerous for thousands of years, and yet the dry cask storage units are only certified by federal regulators for 20 years. In addition to objections from environmentalists and area residents, a prayer vigil was also recently held on the beach near the plant by Native American activists who hope to see the waste removed as well. Edison and the State Coastal Commission tried to get Citizens Oversight's lawsuit dismissed as without merit, but Superior Court Judge Hayes declined to dismiss it and set the April 14th hearing that both sides have now agreed to postpone while they seek to negotiate a settlement and move the nuclear wastes elsewhere to avoid a trial. The reason that spent fuel rods from the nuclear plant at San Onofre have always been stored in cooling ponds on the site before the plant closed is because the federal government never approved a permanent national storage site. Now, however, the Trump administration's budget proposes $120 million toward a permanent nuclear waste repository at Yucca Mountain in Nevada, offering hope for a possible solution at last. Edison closed down the San Onofre nuclear generating stations in January 2012 after radiation leaks from steam generators were detected, announcing permanent closure of the facility in June 2013. After the wastes are removed and the site is fully decommissioned, the San Onofre property will be turned over to the U.S. Navy. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. public interest news for our region.
This is Rebecca Williamson with an update on the case of the missing El Cajon man, Elijah Diaz, known as Bear. Diaz went missing from his home on the night of August 29, 2015. He was 20 years old at the time and has not been heard from since then. Now, Discovery TV's investigation program will be airing a report on the disappearance of Bear Diaz. The episode is titled Every Mother's Son and will air on April 23rd at 7 p.m. Diaz is a diabetic. He had a serious foot injury at the time of his disappearance and was probably on crutches. His family was deeply concerned that he left with only enough insulin for a week and missed several doctor's appointments shortly after vanishing. A private investigator hired by the family called Diaz's disappearance suspicious, NBC 7 reported. A widescreen TV was missing from his room. Diaz left without his toothbrush, glasses, and cell phone charger. He was last seen wearing white baseball shorts and a gray sleeveless t-shirt. He is 5'10", weighed about 110 pounds when last seen, and has brown hair and brown eyes. Adele Weddle, with Bring Bear Home, a Facebook page dedicated to finding the missing young man, says, "We really need to spread the word as much as possible in hopes someone who sees the program will have information that could lead us to how Bear became missing." She hopes that the show will generate some leads in the mysterious disappearance of Elijah Bear Diaz. If you have information about this missing man, please contact the El Cajon Police Department at 619-579-3311. You can also send questions to bringbearhome@gmail.com or post comments on the Bring Bear Home Facebook page.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Gene Carpenter with East County Magazine's Green Scene Report. The drought is out. California Governor Jerry Brown has officially declared it over statewide, thanks to heavy winter precipitation. Groundwater levels in a few areas remain low, so the state will maintain some restrictions on water use to encourage conservation. Statewide, residents are asked to continue avoiding wasting water by hosing off sidewalks or watering lawns during or shortly after a rainstorm. The precautions remain because Governor Brown observes the next drought could be around the corner. Brown did not lift the drought order for Fresno, Kings, Tulare, and Tuolumne, counties where wells went dry and sub-residents are still dependent on trucked-in emergency water supplies. Mandatory 25% cutbacks in water allotments had earlier been lifted for urban water districts in California that had at least a 3-year water supply in reserve, which includes San Diego's local water districts. Meanwhile, the Sacramento Bee reports that state agencies have unveiled a new long-range water conservation plan that will ask all 410 urban water agencies to set and attain their own new targets for water conservation based on local climate, geography, and other factors. Agencies will have until 2025 to comply. The winter rains resulted in a Sierra snowpack that's 61% above normal, with some reservoirs nearly full and the rainy season not yet over. Locally, some reservoirs are now brimming. Lower Otay is at 98% of capacity. Lake Murray is over 84%, and San Vicente Reservoir, where the dam height was recently raised, is at more than 80% capacity. Even three reservoirs long drained down to meet San Diego's drinking water demand are now rebounding. Barrett Lake has topped 35% capacity, and Lake Sutherland is at 44%. Even Lake Marina, which had become scarcely a puddle, is now at 9%. Still low, but enough to reopen the East County Lake for boating, much to the delight of residents and visitors.
The annual Lakeside Rodeo, one of the community's most cherished traditions, is coming up on April 28th through 30th. We thought this would be a good time to replay our amusing interview with Lakeside's rodeo clown. This interview first aired a couple of years ago when the rodeo was celebrating its 50th anniversary, but it's still timely, and the rodeo clown is still performing his antics in the ring, and you can see him at this year's Lakeside Rodeo.
This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Working hard to bring you the wildest jobs in East County. Today, Cody and I went to Lakeside. There we met a man who's going to explain why his workday is more interesting than yours, or at least more likely to end up in a trip, to the hospital. I'm here today with Kevin Higley, who is a rodeo clown. Kevin, how long have you been doing rodeo clowning?
Ooh, that's a dated question, huh? You're going to make me tell how old I am is what you're trying to get at, right? No, I've been actually a professional rodeo clown for 30 years. Prior to that, I participated in high school rodeo and as a contestant, and then I started doing what we call amateur rodeos as a rodeo clown bullfighter, and then I got my pro card and went on to the professional ranks, and so I've been it for, I bet you, total almost 35 years.
So you were doing professional rodeo as what prior to doing the clown part of it?
I was I tried to be a bull rider. Thought maybe I could make a profession out of it and a living. Wasn't very good at that. So what it came to be was my brother was a really good bull rider, and we had what they call a practice pen at home where we buck some bulls and stuff. And so we took turns being the bullfighter who would save the bull rider. Well, boy, I saved him a whole lot more than he ever thought of saving me. And so it became apparent that I was probably a little bit more adapted to the bullfighting area and saving the cowboys. And that was really the love and passion that I had once I got started, that, you know, the thrill of saving a guy so he can get on to another one is really something else. And as time went on, of course, you slow down a couple steps. Not me, but my mind may. I don't know. But anyway, so then I transferred into the rodeo clown / barrel man type aspect of the professional rodeo deal.
Now, you use the term bull fighting, which seems more appropriate to me somehow. So here's another question for you. I've noticed that bulls don't seem to have a lot of sense of humor. So have you actually made one ever laugh?
Oh, yeah, they're always smiling when they run over you. Yeah, well, they've got a smile. You know, a lot of people, they used to say that a bull will actually close his eyes before he runs over you. But that's not true. I can attest to that. They're wide open, and they are laughing. It's like, I got you, buddy. It's good.
So the natural follow-up to that is, how many bones have you had broken?
That's one we don't like to discuss very much. But, you know, I've been really fortunate in my career to stay away from most of the broken bones. I fractured a couple neck vertebrae, and I've had a couple of bones in my foot broke and a couple of things like that. But as a whole, I've been really healthy and really good.
Do you really like to use the word whole when you're talking about bulls and horns and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's kind of, you got to watch that, darling. Put you in a hole.
Now, I'm sure that people, not necessarily associated with rodeo, but people on the outside probably think that you would do this for the thrills. What kind of satisfaction do you get from actually doing this work?
That's a great question. You know, like I said, early on, is just the satisfaction that you've did something to help somebody else to be able to further their career and go on and stuff. So saving a bull rider from a bull or helping him, assisting him to be a higher score, that's where it starts. And that now it's the thrill of entertainment, you know, making people laugh. I just love to hear them giggle and laugh. And so that part is where I'm at now in my career. So we do it for the love, because, you know, unlike a lot of professional sports, the money isn't probably as good as your football, your baseball, your basketball players. But it also is an aspect of it. We do it for the money as well.
Yeah, so you're as a professional rodeo, I see that you have a big trailer. So you travel around from rodeo to rodeo?
I do. Throughout the course of this year, I'll probably be in at least 15 states. I guess the farthest away, which my trailer wasn't able to go with me and a lot of my animals wasn't, was Hawaii. We've actually did rodeos in Hawaii on two of the islands over there.
Oh, really? So you did go to Hawaii, but you just didn't float your trailer across?
No, trailer stayed home as well as my animals that I use in my clown acts, yeah.
Okay, so you do an act out on the in the arena with your own animals. I see you have a dog over there. Is that one of your?
Yeah, I've actually got three or four dogs, and I've got a trick horse, trick mule. You know, sometimes the kids become my tricks. You know, I'm very enthusiastic about getting the crowd involved, and so we use the kids a lot of times in some of the things we do.
If I ever were to find myself in a field with a pissed off bull, because, you know, that happens to me a lot, give me some ideas for how to sort of distract the guy.
Well, you know, so the best thing to do is, of course, it's not all about how fast you can outrun them. It's about the move that you can make to get around them. Because they've got a big old body and they got to bend in half to get to back to where you are. So what you want to do is you want to kind of get in as close as possible and then make that move to the inside and keep them coming. And then when you get to break, you break them so they're on a different lead and you can get away from them.
So you have to fight every instinct, natural instinct, to turn around and run. You have to get close to them, right next to them, in order to be safe.
You're sure better off. Yeah, you're better off. I mean, I know that my legs have never stood around for my face to take a beating, you know. And so it's kind of a natural instinct to run, yes. But, you know, there's a lot of different things you use. The apparel that we wear, the things we wear that gets their attention, that will bring them in your direction, and then it's up to you to make the move to bring them away from the cowboy and to get yourself away.
Okay. Now, professional football players, you mentioned them. They're always complaining about having a short career. Now, you've been doing this for a while. How long would you say the average rodeo clown sort of stays in the profession?
You know, and I guess that would be a term that's kind of tough to use, average, because I don't know any of us that are too, you know. And I guess the guy that kind of I look up to and kind of was my mentor, taught me a little bit, was a guy by the name of Wick Path. And he actually fought bulls at an active level, professional level, till he was 57 years old. It's all about how physically fit you stay. We've got a guy in the business right now that's strictly entertainment. He doesn't even get in the barrel anymore or do any of those things to help out. And he's 78 years old and very active and doing a great job.
Okay, well, see, my son here is, let's say that he goes to see his guidance counselor at school, and the guidance counselor, I've noticed, doesn't have any posters on the wall of rodeos or anything.
No.
But let's say that she says that she's changed her mind and he should forget about engineering and all of that, and he should become a rodeo clown. What advice would you give him for getting into this job, apart from why don't you do something safe like join the Navy SEALs?
Yeah, there we go. Two safe jobs. Well, I'll tell you what the first thing I would do with modern day rodeo, we have schools, and the best thing to do for someone that's inspiring to be a rodeo clown or a bullfighter or a participant, a contestant, is to search out one of those schools and go spend a week, 3 days, whatever the school is, and actually get a head start on what they really could do and if they're adapted for that.
Do you know of any women who do this job who are rodeo clowns?
You know, there used to be, years ago, there was a lady that actually didn't actually do the bullfighting part of the clown, but she got in the barrel and she would tell a few jokes and do stuff. But that was a long time ago. Right at this present time, I don't know anybody, any ladies. I think it has to do with intelligence.
Oh, okay. That's an excellent point. Cody, you have a question?
Yeah, what's the deal with the barrels? What exactly do you do with barrels?
Okay, the barrel is out there for a particular reason. We had put it out in the middle of the arena. Actually, not quite the middle of the arena. It's a little closer to the bucking shoes. And it really becomes kind of like a safe haven for the bullfighters or the bull riders. In case that bull is coming at them, they're caught out in no man's land, they can come there, catch their breath, get away, or at least the bull will be distracted so they can move on. It's my job as a barrel man to position my barrel in a place which will help assist the bullfighters and the bull rider to be able to have a little bit more safety. So, and it's really like sitting in a washing machine just waiting for somebody to turn that thing on, the spin cycle. Because when one of those guys hits it, it can really turn your world upside down.
So it sounds like your job is more about strategy than it is about, I mean, obviously on YouTube or on TV, what they like to show is rodeo clowns being tossed and trampled and all that. But the object is to avoid that and to protect the cowboys and to entertain the crowd, basically, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a given that you're going to be in a very bad situation most of the time, because, you know, you've got an unpredictable animal. He's gonna do what he wants to do. He's gonna do this. So you're gonna be put in a position where you're gonna get in there that you're probably gonna get what they call hooked and thrown out of there. But the better that you prepare yourself to be able to make yourself in the right position to walk away from that, the longer your career will be.
So you're kind of like the ninjas of the West, is what you're telling me.
I never had it put that way, but yeah, cowabunga, dude, let's do it.
Okay, Cody.
So is it true about bulls that they don't like red, like don't like red capes? Is that true?
Great question. You know, and it really is a myth. That doesn't have to do with the red cape that the matadors, you see if the matadors are fighting, or like in our case, we wear bandanas a lot of times on our deals. It's all about the movement. It's the movement of something that brings their attention to it, and that's why when you see the guys with the capes and the matadors, and they can stand in one spot, but the bull will follow the cape and follow that deal.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the people of East County?
Boy golly, if they get a chance, come to the rodeo. They're going to enjoy it.
So, Cody, now that you've seen a little bit of what life as a rodeo clown is like, are you ready to reconsider your future?
No, because as much as my counselors say that I should quit any field that involves thinking, I think I should steer clear of this kind of career.
Are you saying that you don't want to get involved in something that can cow you this much?
You know, I have a lot of beef with you saying something that mean about me, Dad.
Well, I would say that right now my attitude is the lasso your problems.
I just don't know if I'm capable of learning the ropes on this exciting career.
Well, son, that sounds like a lot of bull to me, because I don't know anyone who clowns around as much as you do. This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Clocking out of one of the wildest jobs in East County.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes an extravaganza in Santee, an Easter Carnival in Alpine, Spring Harp Fest in La Mesa, a Save El Monte Valley fundraiser in Lakeside, the opening of Cajon Classic Car Season, and a Clint Black is Back concert at Sequan.
Plus, we'll tell you about coming attractions including Lakeside's Western Days Parade and Rodeo, Spring Garden Festivals, butterfly releases, a fashion show to benefit local arts, the Art of the Quilt in Lemon Grove, community concerts, and Vintage Alpine, a wine-tasting experience in the country to benefit children's causes.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
The City of Santee and Santee Lakes present the 14th Annual Spring Extravaganza at Santee Lakes on Saturday, April 15th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Kids of all ages can enjoy games and activities including carnival rides, pony rides, a petting zoo, inflatable jumps, spring crafts, and live entertainment by Primo DJ. Egg hunts run continuously for children ages 3 through 8. Be sure and bring your child's basket for all of those ages. Food will be available to purchase on-site, or families are welcome to bring a picnic of their own to enjoy at the park. For details, visit SanteeLates.com.
An Easter Carnival and Egg Hunt will be held at the Joan McQueen Middle School in Alpine on Saturday, April 15th. The Egg Hunt starts at 11 a.m. and the carnival runs from 9 a.m. to noon. This family fun event also includes pony rides, a petting zoo, live music and entertainment, inflatable games, a cakewalk, face painting, and an Easter Bunny photo booth. Plus, snow cones, cotton candy, popcorn, and hot dogs will be available.
The 18th Annual Spring Harp Fest, showcasing harmonica players' musical jam fests, will be held on Saturday, April 15th, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Harry Griffin Park in La Mesa. Donations from this event are used to purchase harmonicas for local schools. Get the lineup of talent scheduled at springheartfest.org.
Lakeside residents seeking to save El Monte Valley from a proposed sand mining project are raising money for a legal battle. On Monday, April 17, from 5 to 10 p.m., a benefit will be held at the Eastbound Bar and Grill in Lakeside. Eastbound will donate 10% of proceeds to the Cleveland National Forest Foundation. The money will be earmarked for a special fund to save Lakeside's beautiful El Monte Valley. The event includes prize gift baskets with horse supplies, fishing tackle, gardening tools, and more.
The Cajon Classic Car Show opens its 2017 season on April 19th. Shows will continue every Wednesday night through October 25th. The first car show will involve a full street closure of East Main Street between Magnolia and Claydale Avenues from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. This popular car show is held in the area of the Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon and is hosted by the Downtown El Cajon Business Partners. For more information, visit CajonClassicCruise.org.
Clint Black, the country music superstar, is back with his first album in 10 years, and he'll be performing at Saquon's Live Up Close Theater on April 23rd and 24th. He sold over 20 million albums worldwide, including 22 number one hits. Recordings such as A Better Man, Killing Time, When I Said I Do, and Nothing But the Taillights have won honors from the Grammys, Country Music Association, Academy of Country Music, American Music Awards, plus membership in the Grand Ole Opry. For tickets, you can visit Saquon.com.
Now for a preview of coming attractions.
The 53rd Annual Lakeside Rodeo brings the exciting action of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association to the Lakeside Arena April 28th, 29th, and 30th with four full rodeo performances featuring the seven events of rodeo: bull riding, bareback riding, saddle bronc riding, steer wrestling, calf roping, barrel racing, tie-down roping, and team roping. In addition, the kids' stick horse race is hilarious to watch at each performance. You'll also find vendors to visit, snack bars with tasty treats, beer, and a specialty food booth. All proceeds benefit the youth of Lakeside. For more information and a full schedule of events, visit lakesiderodeo.com.
The 52nd Annual Lakeside Western Days Parade will be held on April 29th, starting at 9:35 a.m. This year's theme is Courage, Honor, and Sacrifice, a salute to our law enforcement. The Western Days Parade is a highlight of Lakeside's Western Days, which also includes the Lakeside Rodeo, April 28th to 30th, to benefit local youth in Lakeside. The parade route is along Woodside and Main Avenues. For details, visit lakesidechamber.org.
The Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College will host its Spring Butterfly and Garden Festival on Saturday, April 29th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Activities include butterfly pavilion and garden tours, butterfly releases, face painting, kids activities and craft vendors, animal exhibitors, educational exhibits and presentations, plus edible, ornamental, and native plant sales. For more information, visit thegarden.org.
In conjunction with the Spring Garden Festival and the Butterfly Festival at Cuyamaca College in Rancho San Diego, the Heritage of the Americas Museum holds a very special drawing each year, the Five Choices Dream Drawing. The drawing will take place at the museum on Saturday, April 29th at 2:30 p.m. The prizes represent the four wings of the museum: natural history, archaeology, anthropology, and art. Proceeds from the drawing will support the nonprofit museum's educational programs that benefit over 5,000 local school children each year. For details, you can visit heritageoftheamericasmuseum.com.
The Lemon Grove Historical Society and Lemon Grove Library are teaming up to present an encore lecture from History Alive, The Art of the Quilt, with quilt historian Sylvia Wallace. This event will be held at the Lemon Grove Library on April 29th at 2 p.m. Wallace's fabulous quilt collection tells the story along with her own words as she traces the quilt from the Egyptians to modern times. From shroud to domestic necessity to political statement to work of art, quilts have emerged not only as treasured family heirlooms but as museum-quality textile artworks.
El Cajon's Friday night dinner and the concert season starts May 5th and will continue all summer long through September 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Prescott Promenade on Main Street in downtown El Cajon. Guests are encouraged to arrive early to dine at a local restaurant or bring your picnic and lawn chairs. These concerts are hosted by the Downtown El Cajon Business Partners. You can see the full lineup of bands soon at downtownelcajon.com.
Friends of East County Arts, Inc., which has supported the arts in East County since 1984, will present Blooming Fashions, a fashion show at the El Cajon Elks Club on Saturday, May 6th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. This year's event promises participants a relaxing afternoon of complimentary champagne, catered lunch, and the latest fashions from Macy's at Grossmont Center. You will also be able to participate in a silent auction, in opportunity drawings, or purchase fusion glass flowers made by students at Flying Hills Elementary by a past grant recipient. Friends of East County Arts has contributed more than $800,000 to art-based groups.
The Alpine Garden Club presents the Waterwise and Butterflies Plant Sale and Festival in Alpine on Saturday, May 6th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Christ the King Episcopal Church in Alpine. Guests will see birds of prey, hummingbirds, shop at vendor booths, and enjoy opportunity drawings and the silent auction. There will also be a Monarch Mania with butterfly releases at noon, with Monarch host plants for sale at Barron's Market in the Alpine Creek Town Center.
The 27th Annual Vintage Alpine event will be held on May 7th from 1 to 4 p.m. This wine experience in the country will take place in the lovely gardens at Summers Pass Farms in Flint Springs, hosted by the Alpine Kiwanis Club. Guests will savor premium wines from California and around the world, also sampling the best that local restaurants from across San Diego County have to offer. The event also includes live music in a garden setting and a silent auction. All proceeds will benefit children's causes across our region. This event is for those 21 and up. For tickets and details, you can go to vintagealpine.org.
The San Diego Festival Chorus and Orchestra will present its spring concert on May 7th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the College Avenue Baptist Church, performing Mozart's Requiem, one of the master's greatest works. In addition, the musical groups will present a salute to Andrew Lloyd Webber, showcasing his unforgettable Broadway musical songs for Phantom of the Opera, Cats, and more. For tickets and details, you can visit sandiegofestivalchorus.org.
That's all for this week.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County. See you around, East County.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
This is Liz Albert with an Aztecs men's basketball report. Steve Fisher, San Diego State's all-time winningest coach and the winningest coach in Mountain West history, announced Tuesday that he is retiring as the head basketball coach at SDSU. Fisher, 72, will continue to work at the university in a part-time capacity. Fisher, who guided the Aztecs to a 366-209 record in 18 seasons, led San Diego State to a Mountain West record 10 conference titles, 8 NCAA tournaments, and 13 postseason appearances. Combined with his previous school, Fisher led his teams to 570 victories, 3 Final Four appearances, 6 Sweet 16 appearances, including the 1989 National Championship. He is a 2-time National Coach of the Year. He is also the recipient of the prestigious 2015 John R. Wooden Legends of Coaching Award. Entering Tuesday, Fisher was the 9th longest active tenured Division I coach in San Diego State's streak of 12 consecutive seasons, with at least 19 victories as tied for the 9th longest active streak. When Fisher arrived at San Diego State prior to the 1999-2000 season, Few could have anticipated the metamorphosis the program would soon realize. In the season prior to his arrival, SDSU went 4-22 and was 15 years removed from its last NCAA tournament appearance. Prior to Fisher arriving on the scene, San Diego State had never won a Division I postseason game and had not even advanced to the semifinals of a conference tournament since 1987. He leaves SDSU having guided the Aztecs to 6 NCAA tournament victories and 8 postseason NIT wins. Additionally, the Aztecs now own the highest winning percentage in Mountain West tournament play among active members. San Diego State is also the league's all-time winningest program in conference wins. As previously mentioned, Fisher inherited a team that won 4 games the season before. In 3 short years, he guided the Aztecs to the 2002 Mountain West Championship and NCAA tournament. In 2006, Fisher coached SDSU to the Mountain West regular season and tournament titles en route to another NCAA appearance. That effort served as a catalyst to a string of 10 straight postseason bursts. In 2010-2011, Fisher led San Diego State to the finest season in school history when the Mountain West champion Aztecs won their first ever NCAA tournament games and advanced to the Sweet 16 before finishing with a 34-3 record. That team ascended to number 4 in the national rankings. Just 3 seasons later, in 2013-2014, SDSU turned in another Sweet 16 performance and posted a mark of 31-5, which included the Mountain West regular season title and the number 5 national ranking. One reason for the program's success has been the remarkable continuity among the assistant coaches and staff. Associate head coach in waiting, Brian Dutcher, recently completed his 18th season at San Diego State, serving as Fisher's top assistant for his entire tenure. In 2011, he was named Fisher's successor as the next head coach. Dutcher will become the program's 15th head coach following Steve Fisher's retirement announcement Tuesday. Dutcher has been on Montezuma Mesa for all of Fisher's 18 seasons. Over the course of his time at San Diego State, Dutcher has helped the Aztecs reach the postseason 13 times, including 8 trips to the NCAA tournament, win the conference best 10 Mountain West titles, and record 12 seasons of at least 20 victories. Since 2008-2009, Dutcher and SDSU twice advanced to the NCAA Sweet 16 and NIT semifinal round, won at least 25 games 7 times, and captured 7 Mountain West championships. Dutcher arrived at SDSU shortly after Fisher was hired on March 26, 1999. In his first year in America's Finest City, the Aztecs won only 5 games, but improved upon their win total from the season before. After that, San Diego State posted a 14-14 record in 2000-2001. Before winning the 2002 Mountain West Championship, earning an NCAA tournament bid, and finishing with a 21-12 record. The 2002-2003 campaign saw SDSU receive an NIT invitation, which culminated in the program's first Division I postseason victory. After helping attract the first McDonald's All-American to the 2002-2003 squad, Dutcher assisted in securing the signatures of future starters and all-league performers Brandon Heath and Marcus Slaughter. The duo started their first 2 seasons on the Mesa, leading to the 2005-2006 season that produced the school's first Mountain West regular season and tournament title sweep. The Aztecs advanced to the NCAA tournament and ultimately won a then-school record 24 games. That appearance led to a string of 10 consecutive postseason berths. With Dutcher on the staff, SDSU won its first 20 games of the 2010-2011 season, served the Mountain West regular season title, and captured the Mountain West tournament crown. The Aztecs moved on to the NCAA tournament as a number 2 seed and won the program's first Division I NCAA tournament game. San Diego State, which was ranked as high as number 4 and received first place votes at one point in the season, advanced to the Sweet 16 and fell to the eventual national champion, finishing with a school record 34 wins, a mark that still stands today. The Aztecs also found themselves in the final top 25 polls, ranking 6th in the AP and 11th in the USA Today coaches poll. 5 months after SDSU's record-setting 2010-2011 campaign, the university elevated Dutzer from associate head coach to associate head coach in waiting. In his first season with his new title, Dutzer and the Aztecs advanced to the 2011-2012 NCAA tournament as an at-large team and recorded 26 wins. The next season, SDSU was again an at-large selection to the 2013 NCAA tournament, moved on to the round of 32 for the second time in 3 years, and finished with 23 victories. Another NCAA Sweet 16 run was in the cards in Dutzer's third season as the head coach in waiting. The Aztecs opened the season by winning 21 of their first 22 games, including 20 in a row at one point, and were led by seniors Xavier James, who had become an NBA draft pick, and Josh Davis. SDSU won the program's second outright Mountain West regular season title and later swept through 2 games in Spokane, Washington, to secure its second Sweet 16 appearance in 4 seasons. San Diego State compiled 31 wins and finished the season ranked 13th in the AP and 12th in the coaches poll after rising to as high as 5th nationally in both polls. Before Dutzer arrived at San Diego State, he served as assistant coach and later associate head coach at Michigan under Fisher. He spent 10 seasons on the Wolverine staff, establishing himself as one of the nation's top assistant coaches. His first year in Ann Arbor was in 1989 and resulted in the national title as he assisted then-interim head coach Fisher on the bench. The Bloomington, Minnesota native led Michigan's recruiting efforts in 1990-1991 when the Wolverines inked Juwan Howard, Ray Jackson, Jimmy Keane, Jalen Rose, and Chris Webber. The Fab Five is considered perhaps the best recruiting class in NCAA history. Dutzer helped lead that group to nearly 100 wins, 2 bursts in the NCAA championship game, and a regional final over a 4-year period. He was also on the Michigan staff for an NIT championship. Dutzer's recruiting prowess, however, was demonstrated by more than just the Fab Five haul. Michigan had the nation's top-ranked recruiting class in 1993, 1994, and in 1994-1995, with a group that included Maurice Taylor and Jared Ward. The accomplishment marked the first time that a university had the nation's top class in consecutive years, according to recruiting analyst Bob Gibbons. Dutzer was born October 30, 1959, in Alpena, Michigan. He attended Jefferson High School in Bloomington, Minnesota, and went on to earn a bachelor's degree in physical education from Minnesota in 1982. While an undergraduate, he worked for his father, then Gopher head coach Jim Dutzer. He then spent 1 season in the prep ranks at Apple Valley High School in Minnesota before becoming a graduate assistant at Illinois, where he earned his master's degree in physical education and athletic administration. While in Champaign, Dutzer helped Lou Henson lead the Illini to a Big Ten championship, 2 appearances in the Sweet 16, and 1 regional final. Dutzer's first full-time coaching job came at South Dakota State, where he spent 3 seasons helping turn around the Division II program before departing in 1988 for Michigan. His final season in Ann Arbor ended with the Wolverines claiming the first ever Big Ten tournament championship.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.